Hi, Marco Werman here. You know my voice from the show, but what you don't often hear are the voices who work behind the scenes. Many talented people bring you the world each day. If you've ever wondered who makes our show, come meet us at theworld.org/whoweare. You'll see the superhero staff that makes the world what it is. The World's Newsroom digs deep into every story, takes risks, and shines a light on the communities most impacted by the headlines. Please take a moment to meet our staff. You'll find us at theworld.org/whoweare. And while you're there, you can also make a difference today in the work that we do by donating $100 or more. That's just $8.33 a month. Your gift can help us keep the show accessible to everybody. Help us make our goal, $100,000 from at least 1,000 donors, and you'll receive a personal invite to a virtual party with the incredible people who make the show. Once again, visit theworld.org/whoweare to learn about our team and donate today. From everybody here at The World, thanks. An Iranian nuclear scientist is assassinated. Some see it as a last-chance effort by Iran's adversaries to complicate future diplomacy.
To set mines and traps that are going to complicate diplomatic efforts between the next U.S. administration and Iran.
Also today, former French President Nicolas Sarkozy in court, facing criminal charges with a lot of the public soaking it up.
The French have cut the head of their king 200 years ago, and in a way, we enjoy bringing down our heroes.
And the Trump administration is looking to increase pressure on Houthi rebels in Yemen. That'd make humanitarian aid to Yemenis all but impossible.
These people will know that the rest of the world, led by the U.S., says you don't matter.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you. We begin today with some good news on the pandemic front. The Massachusetts company Moderna is seeking emergency approval for its vaccine. If granted, the first shots could be given in just 3 weeks. Now, the grim news. The global death rate remains alarmingly high. Around 10,000 people are dying from COVID-19 each day. The U.S. has the highest number of deaths of any country, and public health experts expect things to get worse after millions of Americans traveled and gathered during Thanksgiving. Here's Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday.
If your family traveled, you have to assume that you were exposed and you became infected, and you really need to get tested in the next week, and you need to avoid anyone in your family with comorbidities or over 65.
Assume you are exposed and infected. Over in Europe, things appear to be improving a bit. Restrictions seem to be working and COVID cases are declining, but Europe is not out of the woods. Consider Greece. ICUs are nearly at capacity and a lockdown remains in place. A renewed debate about the role of the Greek Orthodox Church is also flaring up there. Many Greeks have questions after the COVID-related death of a senior clergyman and the hospitalization of the head of the church. The World's Lydia Manalidou has more from Athens.
The story in Greece begins with a spoon. In the Greek Orthodox Church, they use one single utensil to administer communion to the entire congregation. Churchgoers line up, and one by one, the priest spoon feeds them wine and bread, which represent the blood and body of Christ. The mixture all comes out of the same cup, which the priest dips in and out of with the same spoon. During a global health crisis, this might seem like a bad idea, but not according to the Greek Orthodox Church. As the country was diagnosing its first COVID-19 cases in March, senior clergymen like Metropolitan Bishop Ioannis of Lagavas went on TV to tell the public communion was safe. He said neither disease, not even germs, could be transmitted through this holy ritual, that in the course of the church's 2,000-year history, no one has ever gotten sick from it. The bishop wasn't going rogue. This rhetoric was coming straight from the top, from the Holy Synod, the church's governing body. At the same time, church leaders were also encouraging people to listen to medical experts and to take measures to stay safe. But communion, they insisted, was safe. Heated debates broke out on TV. Some publicly criticized the church for being careless, but many didn't want to antagonize what's ultimately an extremely powerful institution in Greece, one that's inseparable from the Greek identity. Today, the vast majority of Greeks identify as Orthodox, even if they're not really religious. Spiridula Thanasopoulou Kypriou, a theologian in Athens, says the church's initial response to the pandemic was unacceptable.
It was a perfect chance to be proactive, to give alternatives, to find solutions, to educate people.
In other parts of the Orthodox world, churches did take extraordinary measures in response to the pandemic. The Archbishop of America, for example, instructed Greek Orthodox churches in the U.S. to start giving people their own disposable spoon. In Romania, they let people bring their own utensils from home. In Ukraine, they started using a method called intinction, where the priest hands out individual wine-soaked pieces of bread to believers. Athanasopoulou Kypriou questions why the Greek church didn't go for one of those solutions.
If they had done this, say, accept to have plastic spoons, more people would go and have communion.
Other theologians have been troubled by this. Sotiris Mitralexis has written two books on the Orthodox Church and was also confused by its stance on communion.
Because it made no sense on any level.
Early on in the pandemic, the World Health Organization started listing saliva as a leading mode of transmission for the virus. So the Church's claim was scientifically questionable.
But it didn't make sense theologically as well. The promise, as it were, that there are no viral infections at play is nothing that Orthodox theology ever promised.
And not only that, but he felt like this whole discussion was missing the point.
Even if the spoon, hypothetically, were not to be infectious in any way, you're either way exposed to the possibility of infection by gathering in a closed space, by kissing icons, etc., etc. So they were not actually discussing about the issue, which is, you know, what are we going to do with the possibility of infection in the gathering that the churches are?
The Greek government did impose some precautionary measures. During the first national lockdown, churches had to temporarily shut their doors. And when they opened, there were attendance limits. But critics say it wasn't enough. At the end of last month, as COVID cases in Greece were rising, hundreds gathered inside and outside St. Demetrios Church in Thessaloniki, in northern Greece. It was for services celebrating the city's patron saint. The church live-streamed them. In this one video, you see people in the pews wearing masks and keeping distances, but later they take off the masks and walk around the church kissing icons and other objects considered holy. Meanwhile, the priests running the service, they didn't wear masks and they didn't social distance. At least two of them later tested positive for COVID-19. Within days, cases in Thessaloniki skyrocketed, and today the region is the hardest hit in the country. It's impossible to say precisely how much events like this contributed to the current situation here, because compared to other nations, Greece doesn't have a good contact tracing scheme in place. But critics and supporters of the church alike say it would be unfair to put the whole blame on the church. Father Themistocles is a priest at a church near Thessaloniki. He says, during the pandemic, churches have been treated and judged more harshly than other parts of society. Like, he remembers when the government started requiring churchgoers to wear masks and social distance. Father Themistocles was taking the bus to work every day. People would wear masks, but the buses were so full it was impossible to social distance there. And meanwhile, people were allowed to crowd other places, like bars and restaurants. They walked around outside without masks. Schools were happening in person. The country was open for tourism. Father Themistocles also rejects criticism that the church didn't do enough to protect people. He says from the beginning of the pandemic, the church has complied with government measures, even ones that go against everything it stands for.
It's difficult because what is being asked of the church is antithetical to the way that it lives and the way that it exists.
Nicholas Denisenko is a professor of theology at Valparaiso University in Indiana and an ordained deacon in the Orthodox Church of America. He says COVID-19 has created tension for the Orthodox Church globally, not just in Greece.
It has adapted, it's been forced to, but it's a struggle.
In Greece, though, the death of a senior clergyman this month has brought that struggle to the forefront. Metropolitan Bishop Ioannis Vlagadas, the one you heard from at the very beginning defending the spoon, he died after getting COVID-19. He was also one of the priests presiding over that big service in Thessaloniki last month. Following his death, church leaders once again went on TV and pushed back against questions about the Holy Communion. But they weren't alone. Even an epidemiologist chimed in. Dr. Athinali Nu said she wasn't aware of any evidence that shows the virus can spread through the communion spoon. When pushed on that, she said, "We can't solve spiritual matters, matters of the Orthodox faith, with logic." Right now, churches are closed as part of the second national lockdown, but they could open as early as next week. Spiridula Thanasopoulou Kypriou, the theologian in Athens, says she expects to see the same course of action from the church.
I don't think they're going to change their mind. They had their chance.
The questions facing the church today, though, go well beyond communion. How will the church respond to the economic and social suffering the pandemic is causing in this country? And how much will science guide their messaging when, say, a vaccine is rolled out? For now, Athanasopoulou Kypriou says, it seems much easier to argue over a holy spoon. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanoulidou in Athens, Greece.
A high-stakes whodunit remains unsolved. Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated on Friday. Most experts are pointing the finger at Israel. Whoever did it, it's going to make things much trickier for the incoming Biden administration as it navigates its Iran policy. Eli Garon-Maya is a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. So, Eli, a group of senior former European diplomats sent an open letter today calling on the EU to work with the incoming Biden administration to bolster the Iran nuclear deal that Trump walked away from. The letter states any escalation in advance of Biden's inauguration would greatly complicate diplomatic efforts. What exactly are these diplomats warning about?
Well, they're warning about exactly the sort of events that we saw unfold on Friday, that proponents of President Trump's maximum pressure campaign against Iran are essentially going to be using this last window of opportunity under this White House term to set mines and traps that are going to complicate diplomatic efforts between the next U.S. administration and Iran. We know that President-elect Joe Biden has already vowed during his campaign to walk the path of diplomacy with Iran and specifically stated a desire to rejoin the transatlantic alliance and to recommit to the nuclear agreement with Iran. And so I think what we are seeing at the moment is that in the final 2 months of the Trump administration, we are going to have potentially back-to-back cycles of escalations in ways that push Iran into a corner to miscalculate and perhaps ties Biden's hands and poisons the diplomatic space for further negotiations once he takes over office.
In the letter, the signatories outlined a number of, frankly, ambitious steps that Britain, France, and Germany, the countries directly involved in the brokering of the nuclear deal with Iran, steps they ought to take in the coming weeks. So briefly, walk us through those steps. What's the plan?
Essentially, it's to pave a roadmap to revive and rehabilitate the nuclear agreement that has basically been on life support through a lot of, I would say, European efforts in the last 4 years to preserve the agreement. And so I think one of the top priority lines here is that the Europeans should coordinate a common policy that pushes for the Biden administration to quickly return to the nuclear deal within the last few months remaining of the current President Rouhani administration in Iran, and to use the political momentum created by the new election inside the US to find ways with Iran to reverse the very troubling nuclear escalation that Iran has basically taken in the last year in response to the maximum pressure campaign from the Trump administration.
Right. Well, as you say, President-elect Biden has said that he's ready, and his quote was, to walk the path of diplomacy if Iran takes steps to show it is ready too. What steps is Europe hoping to see from Iran in this regard?
I think first and foremost, and it's actually, I think, something that probably the Biden camp will also want to see, is Iran quickly reversing nuclear steps that it has taken over the past year and a half that has increased its nuclear capabilities and shortened the so-called breakout capability, the time it takes for Iran to produce a nuclear bomb if it chose to do so. And I think the second critical thing that they'll want to see is that Iran is open to build on this agreement to an extent where the world powers are not concerned about the acceleration of Iran's nuclear activities.
Eli Garanmaya is a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, speaking with us about the road ahead for the Biden administration and Iran. Thanks so much, Eli.
No problem. Good to speak with you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Make no mistake, the human imprint is everywhere on planet Earth, including the tallest points on the planet. Climate change and pollution are impacting the world's great peaks and the Himalayas. It is existential for the billions of people who rely on meltwater from glaciers. It also affects people who attempt to climb the mountains in Nepal, India, and China, mountains like Everest. Aurora Elmore is a climate scientist at the National Geographic Society. I know you've worked with dozens of scientists to install the highest weather stations in the world on Mount Everest. How difficult is it to collect this kind of data?
The process of collecting samples and data from the roof of the world is incredibly arduous. The team up there was having to complete work that specialized scientists do in a lab in conditions that were sub-zero, incredibly windy, and they had to spend almost 2 months on the world's highest mountain in order to achieve their scientific aims.
So weather stations, as I understand them, they gather data like wind speed, temperatures. What were your most surprising findings and what else were you looking for?
Over the last 60 years, glaciers have been melting or glacier mass has been decreasing over the entire region around Mount Everest. What's really surprising about that is even at elevations like 6,000 meters, so that's almost 20,000 feet, we have glaciers that are losing mass because of incoming solar radiation and because of ever warming temperatures because of climate change. Previously, a lot of researchers would have thought that glaciers that high would be buffered from any changes of climate change, that they would just be too cold because of their extreme elevation to show any signs of melt. And we're showing that now that's not true.
So these glaciers are melting at unprecedented rates. What impact does that have on people who rely on glacial melt for their water source?
That's a great question. It's devastating. In just high mountain Asia alone, the glaciers there supply water to 1.1 billion people. That's a seventh of the world's population. They depend on the water from glaciers at a regular rate for things like hydroelectric power, for drinking water, for irrigation. The amount of water that is melting from these glaciers on an annual basis is changing. Right now, more and more water is melting from the glaciers. Eventually, we'll reach a point where there's not enough water left to support the need downstream. Another problem that we need to think about is what happens when the amount of water available comes down all at once, the so-called glacial outburst floods. Water accumulates as it's melting off glaciers and can cause extreme natural disasters to the regions that are depending on this water for their livelihoods and their lives.
One could imagine that a summiting of Everest could be more dangerous as climbers attempt to go up while glaciers are melting. Can Everest expeditions continue safely under these conditions? And what will happen to the money locals rely on, like the Nepalese Sherpas who assist a lot of these climbs, if those climbers stop coming?
Warming temperatures lead to instability of glaciers. You can see more avalanches, more crevasses forming and shifting, and thus making riskier climbs. The livelihoods of people in the Khumbu Valley of Nepal are critically tied to the number of both trekkers and climbers who come to the region. The livelihoods of these people is dramatically at risk. As we've seen right now during the COVID-19 pandemic, when there are fewer climbers coming to the region, it is really terrible for the tourism industry.
Also on top of Mount Everest, scientists found microplastics. How did they get there? And did you find that surprising?
Yes and no. The idea that microplastics have found their way all the way up to 27,700 feet is pretty groundbreaking. It shows that humans have impacted every inch of this planet. On the one hand, it's a really surprising outcome. On the other hand, you know, as Imogen Knapper of Plymouth University, who led that study, says, the fact that there were microplastics in each snow sample that she analyzed really shows how pervasive the influence of humans has been in that region. Some of the evidence of the microplastic work points to the fibers coming from gear from the climbers. When we really love a place and we want to see it fresh and clean, we sometimes damage it just by going there.
Aurora Elmore is a climate scientist at the National Geographic Society. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You know those people who can solve a Rubik's Cube really fast, like in seconds? Yeah, well, I'd like to see them solve what may be the toughest puzzle in the world. It's called Cain's Jawbone. And since it was created in 1934, only two people had solved it until now. Cracking Cain's Jawbone was British comedian John Finnemore's quarantine project. So make it three on the list now. Finnemore joins us from London. John, what is Cain's Jawbone? What kind of puzzle is it?
It was originally published at the end of a puzzle book in the 1930s, but it's been republished last year. And what you get is a box with 100 cards in it. And the 100 cards are the pages of a novel. It's a story of various people murdering each other in very sort of contrived and highly unlikely way, but it's good fun. And the task is to work out what order the pages ought to be in.
What is the origin story of Cain's Jawbone?
So a man named Ernest Mathers used to set crosswords for The Observer, a British national paper, in the 1930s. And he released a puzzle book. The first half were crosswords and acrostics and other puzzles. And then the whole of the second half was the 100 pages of this novel.
So how did you go about solving this? Can you just walk me through your approach?
Yeah, I mean, originally I had a look at it and decided that it was too difficult for me and there was no point. And then when the pandemic came knocking and suddenly said, you know, all that time you wanted to do that thing, well, here you go, knock yourself out. You've got as much time as you want. So I just spread the pages out. There were a few sort of little handhold starting places. There were a couple of poetry quotations that went over pages. So that gave you two in a row you could put together. And then you could start to notice little ticks in the way people spoke or clues about what day or where in the country they were that allowed you to work out some sort of order.
So how long did it take you?
It basically took me the first lockdown we had in this country, which was about 4 months. It felt good because it's a well-designed puzzle. And when you start to make some headway, you know it. It's not a, well, I guess that's as good as I can get it. It's a, if you've got it right, then you'll know.
And what does the publishing company in charge of Cain's Jawbone give you if you succeed at this?
When the competition was originally released in the 30s, they had a prize of £15. So the publishing company worked out what they thought that would be worth in today's money and decided it was about £1,000.
Wow. What's your advice, John, for people interested in trying their hand at Cain's Jawbone? Sounds like a big table to lay all the pages out, for starters.
Yeah, big table is a good start. And then absolutely use Google for everything. I don't see how. I think it would be impossible to solve without Google. It's full of really obscure references to literature and geography and all sorts of things. You need to know about licensing laws in 1930s London, like the way you were allowed to buy a drink without a sandwich and where you could only have one with food after 10 o'clock. The history of prisons comes into it, geography. There's references to people who turn out to be, you know, tennis players from 1930s and when they played a particular match in Wimbledon. So it's not something you can do without a little help from your internet friends.
John Finnemore recently became the third person in history to solve the literary puzzle Cain's Jawbone, designed back in the 1930s. John, thank you very much for being with us, and congratulations.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're with The World. A reminder to listeners, The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. We report stories from around the globe with nuance, context, and by listening to the voices of the people most affected by the news. Donate to The World today to support the work of our superhero staff and help us keep our coverage free and open to all. You can help keep the show accessible to everybody across the globe by donating $100. That's just $8.33 a month. Help us make our goal and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with the incredible people who make this show possible. To give, visit theworld.org/whoweare or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe. Stay healthy, and thank you. The Trump administration took a hard line on trade with China. Some experts say that didn't work out so well.
If the view was that the U.S. could hurt China much harder than it was hurting itself, I don't think the data actually backs that up.
President-elect Biden says he'll take another tack. Some economists are optimistic about that and see a possible breakthrough. That's still ahead. here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The French government today backed down on a controversial security law, one that had sparked nationwide protests over police violence and accountability. France's ruling party agreed to suspend and rewrite the security measure known as Article 24. The draft law included a provision that would have restricted a citizen's right to film and publish images of police on the job. The legislation came under intense public pressure after a recent video surfaced. It showed three French police officers clubbing a black music producer in Paris. The man, Michel Zecler, had initially been arrested for not wearing a face mask.
Et à ce moment-là, moi, j'ai peur. Je me dis, eh ben, je vais, c'est mon dernier jour peut-être aujourd'hui.
Zecler said that during the beating, he was scared and thought he was living the final moments of his life. The officers are now under investigation for unlawful use of force. And the controversy over the proposed Article 24 has now gone well beyond any single incident.
Liberté!
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 This weekend in cities from Paris to Lyon, more than 100,000 French demonstrators took to the streets despite a COVID-19 lockdown. Many carried signs reading, "Let us film, let us breathe," and "Your weapons, our cameras." Meanwhile, there's another story that is gripping France, the corruption trial of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. His nickname was the Bling Bling President. Gives you a sense of Sarkozy's taste for the high life. Today, Sarkozy was in court in Paris to face the first of a series of trials on corruption charges, illegal campaign financing, and influence peddling. Charges the former president vehemently denies. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
When Nicolas Sarkozy lost the presidential election in 2012, after serving just one term in office, he made a promise. "You won't hear about me anymore," he said. The former French leader couldn't have been more wrong. Today, Sarkozy is the first French president in modern history to appear in court on corruption charges. And in spite of the pandemic, the French public is transfixed.
Vous avez l'arrivée de l'ancien président Nicolas Sarkozy.
Les conversations téléphoniques de Nicolas.
There is this morbid fascination, in a way, of having such a powerful man having to face the judge and confirm that his name is really Nicolas Sarkozy.
Pierre Haski is the co-founder of the French news website Rue 89.
Here is a man who looked at one stage as the youthful, energetic politician who's going to renew the country and who ends up in court 10 years later. I think the French have cut the head of their king 200 years ago. And in a way, we enjoy bringing down our heroes.
But to some, Sarkozy remains a hero. His supporters say all the investigations are just evidence of a left-wing plot against him. Many in Sarkozy's political party, Les Républicains, see the former president as the only one who can truly save the party. Rabah Essaoui is an associate professor of French studies at the University of Leicester in the UK.
Broadly amongst conservatives in France, he remains very popular. He's still seen and viewed as one of the most effective, convincing leader of the Conservative Party in France.
But just as Sarkozy is loved, he's also loathed. Many remember him for his hardline policies targeting Islam. French-Algerian journalist Nabila Ramdani says it was Sarkozy who brought in the so-called burqa ban.
The legislation was primarily aimed at putting Muslim women in their place and criminalising the alleged males in their lives who were forcing them to cover their faces effectively, and indeed criminalising anyone who looked too Muslim.
But it wasn't just his politics that rubbed voters the wrong way. Many found his lavish lifestyle and public romance with Italian model Carla Bruni a bit too much.
The early days of his presidency were characterised by dinners with his billionaire friends, super yacht, holiday and private jets. He was also famous for his prestige watches and jewellery and, of course, for marrying a supermodel while in office.
Today, in a very unglamorous courtroom in Paris, Sarkozy stands accused of trying to bribe a judge. It's alleged he asked the judge to reveal details from a separate investigation in return for a cushy job in Monaco. That job never transpired, but prosecutors say there's enough to prove evidence of intent. Sarkozy denies the allegations and says it's a scandal what investigators are putting him through.
Je ne suis pas un pourri.
Et ce qui m'est infligé est un scandale, madame, qui restera dans les annales.
I'm not a crook, Sarkozy said in a recent interview on French television. The truth will come out. But the truth is that the former president is facing a whole host of charges. One of the most serious accusations is that he received illegal funding from the late Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. That money, it's alleged, was used to fund Sarkozy's successful 2007 presidential campaign. He denies the allegations. Sarkozy supporters are hopeful not only that he'll win in court, but that he'll run for president again in 2022. Journalist Nabila Ramdani says she can't imagine the former French leader will ever make it back to the Élysée Palace.
He was a one-term loser who tried to come back in 2017, but was rejected by his own party in the 2016 primaries. But now he's facing multiple prosecutions and is far more likely to go to prison than to get back into power.
No former president in France has ever gone to prison. Rabah Essaoui says Sarkozy being sentenced to jail time will be an extraordinary political moment.
That would mark, I think, a major turn in political traditions where presidents have to some extent been well protected by the French political system. Difficult to say what the court will say, but that would be a major upheaval in France.
The trial, which began today, will run through December 10th. And whatever the outcome, it won't be the last time that Nicolas Sarkozy will be forced to take the stand in a French courtroom. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
It's hard to know what's actually happening in the northern Ethiopian region of Tigray. Communications there have been cut off for weeks. Ethiopia's government says its military forces can claim victory over the Tigray People's Liberation Front, but the leader of the TPLF insists that his troops are still fighting. For an update on the conflict there, we turn to The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi. She's in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Halima, what are you hearing about the situation in Tigray right now? Could this conflict that started early this month be already over?
Well, it doesn't look like it's over, but on Saturday, over the weekend, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said that the federal forces had captured the capital city of that region, Mekele, from the TPLF, or Tigray People's Liberation Front. But hours later, there were reports of rocket fire into neighboring Eritrea, which seems to have possibly been from the TPLF. We don't know for sure, but a couple weeks ago, they had claimed, admitted to rocket fire into neighboring Eritrea. So that's to say is that it doesn't seem as if they're backing down anytime soon. And actually, even today, we're hearing conflicting reports about the situation in Tigray. But again, communications remain blocked. Internet and phone services have been shut off. So mostly we've had to rely on the government version of events, and they're presenting this as a huge victory. In fact, even today, Abiy spoke to parliament for more than 2 hours about the situation there.
Prime Minister Abiy has gotten a lot of criticism in recent weeks from all over the globe. What did he try to convey today in Parliament?
Well, he mostly defended the federal government's position, and the speech seemed to be as much directed towards Ethiopians as to the international community, because many countries have been calling for mediation with the TPLF for weeks, but Abiy has rejected that strongly. He gave a long account of the different ways that, according to him, the TPLF has been undermining his reform agenda. And there, Abiy Ahmed was just saying that within the past 2.5 years of his administration, there have been more than 100 conflicts in Ethiopia, and that's mostly ethnic conflicts. And that's something that analysts have been talking about for years, is the rise of ethnic violence across the country. And Abiy Ahmed has been pointing the fingers at the TPLF.
So what's the response in Ethiopia outside of Tigray, Halima? How much support is there for this war?
Well, the response here has been mixed. First, there is a lot of support for Abiy here. Many people are strongly against the TPLF. They see them as, in some ways, the root of Ethiopia's problems, especially ethnic violence and corruption, because they were the dominant party for so many years before Abiy came to power in 2018. And I recently spoke with a businessman named Sandafa Beke.
Oh, but I'm not his mama.
And he said that he supports Abiy 100%. And he even told me that once back in the day, he was arrested in Addis Ababa here under TPLF leadership. So for him, it's good riddance to see the TPLF be defeated in Tigray. But others who are actually from the Tigray region are really concerned about the humanitarian situation. Recently, I spoke with a young gentleman named Rafael Berhani at a small bar. He's originally from Tigray. And he was telling me that he hasn't heard from his family at all because of the communications blackout for weeks, and he's concerned about what's happened to his family, whether they're alive or dead. He just doesn't know.
I mean, it is a fair concern. The government in Addis reportedly has been shelling the Tigrayan capital of Mekelle. What has been the humanitarian impact there and in other cities?
Yeah, it is concerning. I mean, humanitarian organizations for the days before the government said it would make a move on Mekelle have been sounding the warning alarm because they didn't know what the impact could be or what the military actions would be. That said, during his speech today, Abiy said that the government has been showing maximum restraint. He said that the federal forces have been withholding from striking the TPLF forces when they've seen them close to civilians. And he also made a big claim. He said that, in fact, no civilians were harmed in any military operations, either in Mekelle or in other areas in the past couple weeks, which is a big claim because we've been hearing claims and we've been hearing accusations, rather, of atrocities, both from the federal government forces as well as the TPLF. But because of the communications background, even aid organizations don't really have a clear picture about what the humanitarian impact has been, either in terms of fatalities or in terms of people who have been displaced. It's been very difficult to get that information.
The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi joining us from Addis Ababa. Halima, thanks very much for the update.
Thanks so much, Marco.
For more than 5 years, the U.S. has been supporting a coalition of Arab nations fighting a war in Yemen. The tally of that war so far, around 100,000 people killed, 4 million people displaced. Widespread hunger and disease, creating one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Saudi Arabia supports the democratically elected Yemeni government. Saudi is trying to defeat the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels, who took control of most of Yemen in 2015. For weeks now, rumors have been flying that the Trump administration is preparing to increase pressure on the Houthis, designating them as a foreign terrorist organization. Gregory Johnson at the Brookings Institution has been following the Yemen story since it started. You've been arguing, Gregory, that designating the Houthis would be bad for Yemeni civilians, bad for peace talks, and ultimately bad for U.S. national security. Unpack that for us. Why?
Just to give you a little bit of background, for 2 years I served on the UN panel of experts, which basically oversees a sanctions program in Yemen. And my worry is that a Trump administration designation of the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization would largely have the same impact as UN sanctions have had. That is, it won't do much to influence Houthi behavior, but it will cause a number of unnecessary civilian deaths in Yemen.
So practically, what would that designation do?
So there's a large number of people who live under Houthi control who are dependent upon humanitarian aid coming in that will provide them food, that will provide them medicine. Obviously, the war in Yemen has been going on for 6 years. And so the worry that I have, and I think a number of people in the humanitarian organizations, as well as a number of people up and down the U.S. government, is that if the U.S. were to make this designation and label the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, that means humanitarian organizations would have to stop working with the Houthis, would have to stop putting aid into Houthi-controlled territories.
Right, and specifically it seems that that foreign terrorist designation would make aid groups subject to fines or even criminal penalties for doing the work that they've been doing for the last 5.5 years in Yemen. Here's a comment from Aisha Juman. She's a Yemeni-American who runs a charity that feeds 3,000 families in Yemen.
And these people, where is their last chance? These people will have nothing to eat. These people will know that the rest of the world, led by the U.S., says you don't matter.
And Gregory Johnson, that probably rings true from what you know. Don't a lot of Yemenis feel the world has already turned its back on them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the UN classifies the war in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And the real tragedy is that it's a humanitarian crisis that's entirely man-made.
We should say that some Yemenis want the Houthis to be designated as terrorists. Those Yemenis have seen the abductions, the disappearances. They've seen the Houthis use sexual violence as a weapon of war. I'd like us to hear Afra Nasser, a Yemeni woman who works with Human Rights Watch, and she drew our attention to a recent protest in the central Yemeni city of Taiz.
There was a protest in Taiz last week. People holding banners that says, with one voice, we demand the designation of the Houthi armed group as a terrorist group. So I understand the unspeakable suffering of civilians in Taiz who have faced indiscriminate shelling and attacks. But the designation in and of itself will not provide justice for victims in Taiz or any place in Yemen.
So, Gregory, if not justice, could a terrorist designation provide leverage for negotiators? We know that the UN's Martin Griffiths has been shuttling between the warring sides to try and get a ceasefire in Yemen.
Yeah, so this is what the Trump administration and people in the administration, such as Secretary of State Pompeo, have been arguing, that basically, look, the international community does not have a great deal of leverage over the Houthis, and designating them as a foreign terrorist organization would give us basically a stick in which to compel them to make a deal with the Saudi-led coalition. But designating them as a foreign terrorist organization and essentially criminalizing activity, which would cut off humanitarian aid into Houthi-controlled areas, it's not going to do much good.
So the designation of the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, it has not happened yet. Do you think it's likely, though, Gregory?
Everything that I'm seeing from people that I've been speaking with in Washington, it appears as though the Trump administration really wants to make this happen. I know that internally there has been significant resistance from a number of different departments, whether that's in the Department of Defense or the State Department or other organizations. It's unclear whether the Trump administration will sort of be able to override those professional concerns and make this designation on their way out the door. That, I think, remains to be seen probably in the next week or two.
Gregory Johnson is with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. We've been talking about the potential impact if the State Department designates Yemen's Houthi government as a foreign terrorist organization. Gregory, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Marco.
We asked the State Department today for comment. A spokesperson there told us the Houthis need to change their behavior and stop exacerbating Yemen's humanitarian crisis, and that the U.S. remains committed to a peaceful, non-military solution. We've all been making changes lately. Can't go on as normal. Here's one adjustment that might make your day go a little better. A quick hit of news from around the globe. Our morning newsletter, Top of the World. It is free. Sign up for it at theworld.org/newsletters. The trade relationship between the U.S. and China can essentially be boiled down to one word, war. It is a trade war, true, but still a conflict between two superpowers. President Trump slapped tariffs or import taxes on billions of dollars of Chinese goods. Then China hit back, and Trump hit back again, and around we've gone. President-elect Joe Biden has been critical of this approach. So what happens now? Joining us to look ahead is Lee Brandstetter. He's a professor of economics and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Lee, the goal of the so-called trade war was to rebalance the trade relationship between China and the U.S. and give a boost to American manufacturing. That was the idea. How successful has that plan been?
It has not been successful. First of all, the tariffs that were imposed on U.S. imports for China have really hit American consumers and American businesses quite hard. Consumers pay more for Chinese products. U.S. businesses that use Chinese goods as an input into their own production also pay more. But if these tariffs were meant as leverage to get China to fundamentally change the way that it operates its economy, that hasn't worked either.
So are you saying the net result is kind of the opposite of what Trump was hoping for?
When the trade war really got started back in March 2018, the Trump administration actually identified a number of issues with the Chinese economy that have been noted by previous U.S. administrations. A few of these are the massive subsidies the Chinese government uses to promote its own industries, the way that it walls off important segments of its economy from foreign competition, and the ways in which the Chinese government intervenes to force foreign companies to transfer strategically significant technology to Chinese entities in order to get market access. We thought that a Trump administration trade strategy might actually try and address some of these issues, and it really hasn't.
So Joe Biden has said Trump has gone after China in the wrong way. But now that these tariffs are in place, I mean, how easy will they be to get rid of? And do you think Biden will?
I think the Biden administration will work towards a more comprehensive trade agreement with China that eventually reduces and perhaps even phases out most of these tariffs, maybe all of them. So what I would expect the Biden administration to do is actually move beyond the unilateral measures of the Trump administration to work with America's trading partners and allies, and then get this coalition to agree on a strategy that might get China to behave in a way that's consistent with its WTO obligations and its past promises.
So how should Biden approach China with all these goals in mind?
There are a number of things we could do, I think, that the Chinese would really welcome. And that's not just the reduction in tariffs, but also other ways of increasing China's influence in the existing structures that we have, including the WTO, the IMF, and the World Bank. What's also true is that China's development strategy really does rely on continued access to American technology, American components, American high-tech goods and services, right? So these are all important avenues of leverage that a Biden administration could utilize.
How hopeful are you that China and the U.S. will engage in that productive strategy?
I don't expect that we're going to get there overnight. In fact, I suspect that dealing with China could become one of the toughest foreign policy challenges facing the Biden administration. But I do think that we have a moment of opportunity here if only both sides will take advantage of it.
Lee Branstetter is a professor of economics and public policy at Carnegie Mellon. Thanks very much for being with us, Lee.
Thank you, Marco.
The transition between U.S. presidents will have a deep impact outside the U.S. Among the people watching these changes is Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She's a former president of the West African nation of Liberia and a Nobel Peace Laureate. President Sirleaf, thank you very much for being with us. In your opinion, how do you think the Biden administration could change the U.S. relationship with African nations?
I believe that President Biden would have a policy for Africa, and that policy would take into account that the African continent is the continent of the future, given our youthful population, our natural resources, and our young technocrats. And we hope that policy will go for strong partnership, but one in which Africa's own agenda is one of self-reliance, self-determination, and control of its own destiny. There may be some changes here and there, but we expect that the fundamentals of United States policy will be maintained from one administration to the other.
Do you think the fundamentals of a U.S. policy toward Africa were evident as Trump has been president? As you know, he had some nasty things to say about Africa.
You know, we did not pay much attention to things that were said off the cuff. But there were certain programs from President Bush, from President Obama, that were continued. And don't forget, the United States plays a big role in the United Nations.
I actually wanted to ask you about Joe Biden's nominee for the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She is Linda Thomas-Greenfield. How do you see her operating at the U.N.?
Linda Thomas-Greenfield is a diplomat par excellence. She has all the critical skills necessary to restore America's image and credibility and leadership that may have been affected in the past few years. She is particularly close to Liberia because she came when she did what was required to prepare for her master's thesis. And so she worked in one of our rural areas. And subsequently, of course, she became the U.S. ambassador to Liberia at a time when I also have become president of Liberia. So, I it's hard for me to call her Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield because I just know her as Linda.
You're that close.
We are that close. She understands the culture and tradition of Africa. She took the time to learn them, to know them, to respond to them. She's an excellent negotiator. I can tell you that because when I took over, I had to negotiate with people who were warlords, and we needed to make sure that we got them to have the confidence to support my administration. I couldn't have done it unless I had a few people I could count on for counsel, and Linda was one of those.
What effect could Linda Thomas Greenfield have as the U.N. ambassador to the United Nations on the U.N. itself?
I think she would work very well with the Secretary General of the U.N. to ensure that the whole thing about peacekeeping missions have better structures, that negotiations of peacekeeping are put largely in the hands of women who are better able to make peace and to negotiate peace, that representation of the United Nations in countries throughout the world will see more women and more young people. I expect her to do all that, and I expect her to be a great negotiator for the United States.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is the former president of the West African nation of Liberia. Thank you very much for your time.
You're most welcome.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be healthy, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
From PRX.